Good afternoon. So I'm going to start with this question here. So we're saying I have a system, we're running two applications, and A wants to read from the network, B does a lot of computation so we can always run it if we have nothing else to do. And I'm saying that we start out where A calls read to get, ask for 8 kilobytes of data, and it needs to wait for that data. So the data is not available right now. So later, 16K of data comes in, so that read gets 8K of that. And then A processes that 8K and says, oh, there's more, and calls read again to get 4K more. And I'm asking, when this happens, how many kernel user mode switches, so in either direction, this is both directions, are there going to be? And how many context switches are there going to be? This is process context switches, to be completely clear, hopefully. So I'll give you some time to think about that. Remember to think about how our device drivers work. We talked that we had part of the device driver that ran from the read or other IO request, and part that ran from the interrupt handler, and they sort of have this shared buffer. The read would check that buffer, the interrupt handler would typically fill that buffer or drain the buffer in the case of writes. I'll give another 30 seconds or so, maybe a little more because the response rate's a little low so far. Guess I'll close it, last chance. Like. two more people to be answering, but and there we go. Okay, so don't have consensus here. So a lot of people like 3 followed by 6, not really consensus. Let me go through, and for process context, which is we have mostly 2 or 3, sometimes 4. Let me go through sort of how I work out this scenario. So initially A is running, is my assumption. Then we have its read happens, and that goes a system call, so that goes from user to kernel mode. And then that system call determines, oh, it runs the top half of the device driver, it looks at the buffer, it says, oh, there's not AKA stuff here, so it starts waiting. And when we're waiting, we're not just going to waste time, we're going to do something with the CPU. So assuming we wait a reasonable amount of time, we're going to end up running B and doing its computation in user mode. And then at some point, the data is going to come in on the network, and that's going to trigger an interrupt from the device, which will run our trap handler, which will run the bottom half of the device driver. So that's going to be in kernel mode, in interrupting B, and it's going to process the data from the device, and it's going to realize, oh, this program A, it was running previously, I should mark it as ready now. And multiple things could happen here. So one option is that we could say, have the scheduler decide, oh, A is more important than B because A is like hasn't been using the CPU for a while and it might run A immediately. Or alternately, it might decide to wait for a while and not switch to A right away, in which case maybe B would run here. And that's why I have this in gray. So either like we just switch to A and do this stuff right away, or we run B for a while before the scheduler decides, okay, now it's time to run A. So we think of XV6's scheduler, it would wait for a timer interrupt. So this gray portion would be filled with B. Whenever we decide to run A, we're gonna switch to A, we're gonna be in kernel mode, and we're gonna execute the rest of this top half of the device driver. So this top half, it stopped to pause the process. It's going to start running again, and it's going to check, okay, I have the data in the buffer. Now I can finish copying it and returning a value to the application, giving it its first 8K of data. Then A is going to process that data, decide to make its second system call. And this time, our top half is going to check, okay, is the data in the buffer? Answer is yes. And it's just going to get returned without needing to have A start waiting again. So if we count the mode switches here, we have 1 to start running the system call for read, a second to start A waiting and run B in user mode, then a third to run the trap handler to handle the I/O, and if we assume that we switch to A right away, a fourth for returning from that system call, and a fifth and a sixth for starting and returning from the system call, the second read system call. If we assume we run B in the middle, we have 2 extra context switches, sorry, 2 extra mode switches. We're gonna switch mode switch to run B in user mode and then back to kernel mode to finish running the system call for A. So questions on how I did this logic and the answer I came up with. And I think most of you did 3, we're only counting, I would guess we're only counting the switches in one direction, which makes sense, but that's not quite what the question was asking. So for context switches, we can use the same diagram. If we assume that we don't run be in this meanwhile, we have two. And if we do, well, we still have two. This is not a context switch. We just in B, we're running part of the device driver. So I just count two context switches. Two process context switches. So questions about how I figured this out and about this timeline. So some other stuff. So that was about sort of the top and bottom half of device driver. So you said we have this top half, which executes from the system call or other IO request. So we also saw we could have like IO from like a page fault and things like that. Uses a buffer to check for data, request data if needed, and then waits for that data by putting the process to sleep until the buffer gets filled. And the bottom half of the device driver, where it comes from interrupt, fills the buffer and wakes up the process. And the same thing also applies to writes. So in that case, the request is actually a request to send data that we put in the buffer and wait for that to be written. And the instead of filling the buffer, we drain the buffer. But the same principles apply otherwise. We also talked about, well, what are we doing when we're talking to the device? And we said that the devices are going to be attached to this memory bus, and we can access them as if they were memory regions, and the device controller can decide what reading and writing that memory does and make it more convenient for the type of the device that it's implementing. And way before we talked about devices, we finished up talking about page caches. And we specifically examined some scenarios in which our main idea for page replacement, this least recently used based policies, didn't work out. And these were all based on sort of scans over data. And one example was that when we were only using data once, LRU would keep that data in the cache and therefore use space that we really would have preferred to use for data we're actually going to use again. And we saw one solution to that was sort of have this special case to try to guess, oh, this is only going to be used once. We also saw that with scans, we can do better than waiting for a program to access some data. We can say, oh, you read the first few parts of that file, you're probably going to read the next one, and we can make that guess and we call that read ahead. And the idea is that we can avoid having an expensive page fault in the first place by anticipating the program's actions. So I'm going to finish up talking about devices today by extending this idea of devices sort of as magic memory and talk about other things devices can do with memory. But before I get to that, so any questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so in that case, we're going to talk about something called direct memory access. And this is going to be based on a cute feature of this picture that the device controller is connected to the memory bus just like the processor is. And that means the device controller is just as capable of talking to the memory as the processor is. And this means that we can have the device controller actually access this memory. And you might ask, why is that useful? Well, one reason to think of why it's useful is to think of what we were doing in the case where we had these device driver bottom halves. All they were doing was copying from the device controller into memory, into that buffer. And what, like, this seems like an extra step. The device controller stores things here, then the processor moves them into the processor and then back into over here, but we actually have this more direct connection. We should take advantage of that. And there's some scheme that some device controllers use called direct memory access where that's exactly what we're going to do. And what we're going to say is, okay, rather than having buffers in the device controller, we're going to replace that with a control register the OS can set with the buffer address. And the idea of this is that the OS is going to choose a place for the device controller to put its buffer and tell it by sending the physical address to the device controller with a memory write. And now when the device controller gets data from the device, rather than just keeping it in this internal buffer, it's going to send it directly into memory at the address the operating system said it should. Then later on, rather than the OS reading, copying from the device controller buffer, it just accesses this buffer that it set up previously directly. And this buffer location could be exactly that device driver buffer that we were talking about using before, so we've now skipped a step. Now, we still have to do something whenever the device reads things, because we still, into memory or writes things out, because we still need to run code to do things like wake up someone who was waiting for data to be read, but we don't actually need to do the copying. And so that's going to save a bunch of time. Also, you could imagine if we were really clever, maybe we could pass the location where we actually want the data in the first place. And this sounds like a great idea, and it's conceptually a good idea, but it's actually really hard to pull off. We'll talk about why in a little bit. But even if we're just, using this as our kernel buffer, it's going to be much faster. So, especially for like disk or network IO. So for something like the keyboard, this isn't really worth it because we're still going to need to have the OS get notified every time there's keyboard input. It still needs to check, things like a status register on the keyboard to know what happened. So for that, we aren't really gaining anything. But when there's a lot of data to copy, we're avoiding this loop of copying data. And in fact, while that's happening, while this write is happening, the processor, if it's not using the memory, it can run just as fast as it was before. It's not using the memory much. It also gives the device a bigger buffer space. And yeah, if we're really clever, we can actually put the data right where we want it. As long as we can tell the device driver, here's the physical address to use. So questions about this idea? Okay, so this idea of putting the data where it wants, so this is how well this works varies. So if where it wants equals page cache, maybe can do this, most of the time. Okay. So for the page cache, it's relatively straightforward. The OS allocates that space. It knows it can make that be set up correctly, so this probably could work. But in the more general case, like my network IO example, this is a great goal, but how to actually accomplish that is much more complicated, and usually OSs do not succeed. Usually they're going to put it in the device driver's buffer. At least they're still skipping a step, so we're going from copy from device controller to device driver, from device driver to application. Now we're just copying from device driver to application, and the device controller is handling the first step. So we've saved a copy, but it would be really great if we could just put it right where the application wanted it, like the pointer that was passed to read. But this is very hard to do because of many considerations. So one issue is if it's a read for a regular file, we actually want to go to the page cache first, so we want an extra copy operation to cache the data. If it's something else, well, the device often has constraints that are going to be hard to satisfy with the pointer that the application made up. So the device might want contiguous addresses. So, we get, two pages of memory, they might have non-contiguous physical addresses, but if we're giving the device a physical address, that might be tricky. The device might only write, you know, at the beginning of a physical page, and if you didn't pass a pointer that was at the beginning of a page to read, sorry, the OS can't do this. There's all sorts of problems like that. So in practice, usually, especially with things like network devices, unless you're doing a lot of extra work, you're going to end up going to the device driver's buffer, even though it's a really great goal and should help performance a bunch if you could avoid this copy and have the device do all the work for you. But regardless, this idea still is much faster if we're just avoiding any just one copy. So questions on direct memory access. Quiet chat. Okay. Yeah, all these. So that's what we had on devices. So we have these key ideas that we have these device controllers connected via the memory bus with things on the device controller assigned physical memory addresses, which the OS accesses as if it were normal memory, except the device controller decides what loading and storing from that memory does. Can trigger operations, whatever makes sense for the kind of device it has. And we had these two options for device transfer. So we had the first scheme, which is known sometimes as programmed I/O, where there's a buffer on the device controller that the OS can access like memory, and it copies from that into whatever the device driver uses, or where we have something called direct memory access, where the OS allocates whatever buffers it needs and just tells the device controller about it, and the device controller accesses that as needed. So final questions before we stop talking about how devices work, how we do I/O in our operating system, how we implement device drivers. So our next topic is going to be about file systems. I'm going to start by introducing the FAT file system. We're using this as our starting example for a couple of reasons. So one reason is that it's actually widely used, even though it's very old. Probably the simplest file system that is widely used. It's really a family of file systems, but we'll just introduce sort of the typical things that FAT file systems do in general. Also because it's going to be our next assignment is going to be having you implement something which reads something formatted as a FAT file system. So the name FAT comes from file allocation table. So the file allocation table is the main data structure in this file system, and we're going to talk about what that looks like in a bit. So to introduce this file system, what a file system does. The idea is that we take a disk, which doesn't have any native notions of files or directories, and we're going to have somehow divide it up into files and directories and support all this. So to think about what problem we have here, we need to say, well, how is the disk actually organized? And our model is going to be that the disk is just like an array of stuff. And in FAT, we're going to divide up the disk into units we're going to call clusters. Each cluster is going to be some amount of that space. In FAT, the size will vary. We'll talk about how you figure out what it is a bit later. But we'll say it's like typically for like 512 bytes to 4K. Now, a cluster is going to be how FAT divides up the disk, how the file system does it. But for reasons of being kind of independent of how the disk works, This is not the same necessarily as how the disk divides up itself. And we're going to call the units the disk divides itself up into sectors. So a sector is what the hardware supports for reading or writing. So the hardware is going to decide how it works and choose a size you can read or write. And FAT's going to group those together depending on what's convenient into clusters. So historically, sectors the hardware supported were 512 bytes. These days, they're often a bit bigger because people decided that, you know, half kilobyte's actually not very much. And FAT's going to take these sectors and group them together into clusters. So in this picture, I've decided that each cluster that FAT's going to manage is going to be composed of four sectors. Now sectors, since they're the unit the hardware does, if we say want to read this part of a sector, we have to read the whole sector and then extract that little piece. If we want to overwrite this part of a sector, we have to read the whole sector, replace this part, and write the whole thing back, because the hardware only knows about reading or writing these whole sectors. So that's sort of the hardware unit. And in fact, it often is the case that that the hardware unit, even though it seems like kind of awkward to work with, have to work with these larger units when we're used to, like in our programs, dealing with byte at a time, it turns out that it's going to be awkward to deal with such small units, so often we'll group multiple of them together into a cluster and work on a cluster at a time. And the main reason for doing this is that's going to lower the amount of bookkeeping we have to do at a cost in terms of efficiency. Efficiency in terms of other types of efficiency. We'll look at that in a second. So now that we know how I've divided up things into clusters and sectors, so first questions, because it's important that we understand what clusters and sectors are, or else a lot of what I'm about to talk about will be extremely confusing. Questions on what clusters and sectors are. Looks quiet. So now that we've divided up this disk into clusters and we've given each one a number, so we have a file and we're going to have, okay, we're going to go back. Question. So how can you tell the cluster size of the hardware? So the hardware, there's a terminology thing. Cluster, this is a software concept. Sector is the hardware size. So how do I tell the sector size? Then the sector size, the hardware has to tell you. How this works depends on the type of hard drive you're dealing with, is my understanding. In some older hard drives, like it was fixed based on the connector. In newer ones, I don't actually know offhand, but there's some way that the hard drive or SSD communicates it to the device controller, so the OS can read it out of the device controller and figure out what's going on. Does that answer your question? So now that we know that we've divided up this disk into these clusters that the file system is going to manage, we have to figure out how to store a file, and we want to have many files. And what we're going to do is we're going to assign a list of clusters to a file. Now you might say, well, my files aren't all multiples of, say, 2 kilobytes. If you have 2 kilobyte clusters, what am I going to do? What we're going to do is we're going to store the file in as many clusters as we need, and we're just going to waste some space at the end of the last one. So it's not a multiple cluster size, too bad. We're only going to track which file each cluster is assigned to. We're not going to subdivide them. To keep things simple, this is a simple file system. We're doing simple things, even though they might waste space. And so this means if you want to read a file, our task is going to be that given the file that the user wants us to read, we're going to have to figure out what this list of clusters is. So we'll have, like, say, example.txt assigned to clusters 10, 13, 14, and 15. And we need to somehow be able to go from example.txt to that list. And we're going to talk about how we do this in two sort of sections. In the first section, I'm going to say, given that I know where the file starts, how do I get the actual list? In the second section, I'm going to say, given that I know what the name of the file is, how do I find out where it starts? So I'm going to start out with, given that I know where the file starts, somehow I figure that out, how do I figure out where the rest of the file is? And this is where our main data structure, the file allocation table, comes in. So the file allocation table is just a big flat array on disk. And what we're going to do is we're going to store the list of cluster numbers as a length list. But we don't have memory locations, so we're not going to have pointers. Instead, we're going to have an array of sort of next pointers, but rather than being pointers to a memory location, they're going to be cluster numbers. That's how we're going to point to the next thing. So this array contains an entry for each cluster with the number of the next cluster. So here, this says cluster 0. After that, in the file that contains cluster 0, is cluster 4. And we'd have to go to cluster 4 to figure out there. And this forms a linked list. So this means if we know the starting cluster, let's say we know a file starts at cluster 1000, we know the cluster after that is cluster 4503. So given that we have this array on disk, we're going to figure out the right indexes into the array based on first starting with our starting cluster number. So let's say that we have our example.txt that starts at cluster 10. So I'm going to read the part of the array containing index 10. I'm going to get, okay, the next number is 14. Then I'm going to read the part of the array containing index 14, get the next cluster is 15, read the part containing 15, get the next cluster is 13, read the part contains 13, and I get this special value. So we don't have null pointers because these aren't pointers to memory locations, but we do need a sentinel value, like for a linked list, to represent the end. In my examples, I'm using -1, but it may be different in the real fat, which I'm mentioning because this comes up on the assignment. So the question is, if we're doing read ahead, do we read directly from the fat? So if we're doing read ahead, what we want to do is we want to have loaded the relevant part of the fat in advance, so then we can queue a request to, for example, read sectors 13 through 15 in advance after knowing the program runs, clusters 13 through 15 after knowing the program runs 10. And to do that, we'd have to have read the fat in advance. The most common implementation strategy these days is to actually load most of the fat into memory in advance so we can do these lookups quickly. But that historically might have not been the case for memory constraints reasons. And on some like devices without much memory, you might not do that either. Does that answer your question? Yeah. And note that this array, this is not the actual data for these clusters. This is just metadata. And a good question is like, where do we store this array? You know, we know it contains the numbers of the next clusters or this, or our special value that marks the end, whatever that we choose to use for that. We have to place it somewhere on the disk. And what that does is we're going to just store this entire array contiguously in some of the clusters near the beginning of the disk. I'll talk later about how do we figure out where exactly it is. So we have our array here. And you know this array tells us where files are. So if there's a file that starts on cluster 7, for example, we know that the first part of the file is cluster 7, then 8, because it points to 8, then 9, and then that's the end of the file, is in cluster 9. So the file is divided up into three blocks. Similarly, we have our file at cluster 10, where we have 10, then 14, then 15, then 13. So to read this file, we need to read all of these clusters and then organize the data in the correct order, because the program expects to get 10, then 14, then 15, then 13, even though they're not stored in that order on the disk. And we have a whole bunch of other files here. So I have other point you know, pointers here that represent other entries like 11 points to 23, and so on. The question is, why are files stored contiguously? So as we'll learn next time, it would sure be nice if we stored most of our files contiguously, but not having to store files contiguously gives us more flexibility. For example, later on, we're not going to have to do a lot of work to find a place to put a file because we have that option. Does that answer your question? Okay. So now that we know how the fat works, let's think about how we're, you know, how we do like read files. So read a file, we have to get its starting location. We'll talk about how we do that next. Then we read the first cluster of the file. Then we get the next cluster number from the fat entry for that cluster, read the next cluster, and so on until we get that a special value that we know represents the end of the file. So there are two things which we're missing here. So we're missing the start location, and we're also missing, you know, what about, you know, extra data in last cluster. And we're going to have to answer both of those questions. And by extra data in the last cluster, I mean, for example, if we have 2KB clusters and a 3KB file, well, the 3KB file is one full cluster and half of the other of the second. How do we have to somehow know that we only need half of the second? And we're going to solve both of these problems in the same way. But before I talk about those, everyone clear on this procedure for using the fat? Okay, don't see questions. So to get start locations, what we really want is file names. And we have to have somewhere that we store file names. And the answer is we're going to store them in directories, which gets to the question of what is a directory? And in fact, a directory is a file. But, and it's going to be stored like a file, so it's going to have a list of clusters, which contains its data. But rather than its data being something the user requested to write, its data is going to be a list of information about files, including possibly other directories in that file. Notably, it's going to include its name and also its starting location. So this is how we're going to find, take a name like, you know, index.html and figure out where's the file for that. And this other data is going to include things like the size, and we'll see some other examples of data we'll store. So, for example, let's say I have a directory that starts at cluster 9. Then, you know, I'll look at my fat and maybe my directory is divided up into two blocks stored in cluster 9 and cluster 13. And in each of those, we have data for the directory, and that data is going to be a list of directory entries. Each one of those gives a name, a starting cluster number, and also a size and some other data. I'll show you exactly what directory entries look like on the next slide. So in this example, we have index.html starts at cluster 10. So we read the fat to figure out here's how it's laid out. In this example, I say, you know, it's an order in this case. So we get these pointers from the fat, and we say, these are the clusters containing the file's data. We'd look at the size here and figure out, oh, because the clusters in this case happen to be 4 kilobytes, and this size is not a multiple of 4 kilobytes, that means that there's a bunch of unused space at the end of the last cluster. So when I read this file, I'll just remember to ignore that. And this is how we're going to access the file. So questions on the sort of high level view of what directories look like. The question is, how do we find out what clusters directories are in? So if the directory is in another directory, we're going to find out because there's going to be a directory entry. Like here I have one represented. If it's not in another directory, we're going to have a special case for the root directory, and I'll talk about that in a bit. Does that answer your question? Okay. So that's our directory. So let's look at what one of these directory entries actually looks like in FAT. So this is the layout byte by byte. This quote R represents the ASCII character capital R. And for other things, I have the hexadecimal value of each byte. So we have our starting cluster number. And FAT has a lot of history. So this looks probably really ugly and silly, and it is because of the history. So one piece of history is that the starting location, the starting cluster number, is stored in two pieces. The history behind this is it used to be 16 bits, so it used to just be this number. But then they realized that that wasn't big enough because maybe you want more than 2 to the 16 clusters on your disk. So they added a second two bytes to make it 32 bits. So it's split up into two pieces. Each of these pieces is stored in the little endian, which is why this is 0100. The 00 I just didn't write there. And why this is F404, F4 is the least significant part. Okay. We also have the file name. And FAT supports an 8-character file name here, followed by a 3-character extension. You might say that seems awfully inflexible. And yes, it is. This is what DOS decided to do, and for a while, that's all the people who made FAT cared about. Now, FAT does support longer file names. We're not going to talk about how they work in much detail or have you implement them for the homework. The way FAT longer file names work is that they're actually encoded using multiple directory entries. And the only reason for that is because they started with a scheme that only supported these 8+3 character file names, and they wanted to add on to it without breaking old stuff. In a modern design, you'd probably just make this bigger. Okay. We also have this attributes field, and this contains information like, is it a directory, subdirectory or not? Is it read-only? So that sort of meta information about the file is encoded in this byte, where specific bits mean specific things. This also is how they mark, oh, this is a directory entry that's part of one of those sequences to hold longer file names. That's how, so where that information is marked. So something which showed up on our previous slide was that we can have unused entries in directories. So one reason for this is when we delete a file, we could go through and rewrite the directory to omit the file we deleted, but that's awfully annoying in a big directory. So instead, we just like to overwrite the directory entry to mark it as deleted, and that's supported because of how these first character is interpreted. So they've decided that they're not going to use the character OXE5, to represent a file name. So if that appears in the first character of a file name, it actually means that it's deleted. That's an unused entry that could be reused later, probably representing a deleted file. Another thing is that rather than relying on a size from something else, we're going to indicate the end of our directory with an entry with a null character here. So they use a null at the end of it so they can easily figure out where the directory ends without dealing with sizes. So the question is, if I have a 10-character file name with a 1-character extension, then I can't store it in here? That's right. So 1-character extensions are supported. So like if we wanted to do hello.c, that would be represented like hello:\c\. But hello world, sorry, you can't do that without the special thing where we use multiple directory entries in some way. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yeah, so this is just limitations because DOS didn't care about being convenient. So you notice there's some other fields here. So we have a bunch of creation time, a last access date, a last modification date and time. You might wonder what the format of this is. You can look it up. I'm not going to talk about it much because it's really weird and not particularly important. And we also importantly have the file size. So this is how we know how much of the clusters the file points to are actually used. We don't have something like in the directory, like something at the end to tell us where it ends. So questions about our directory entry formats? Okay, so I've shown you what the format is pictorially, and in your assignment, and also in real OSs, you need some way of like conveniently accessing this. And what most commonly is done is that you'll write out this format as a struct in C or whatever language you're using that will be laid out the exact same way in memory. So we've just carefully written this struct declaration to make sure it has the exact same representation in memory. And that means what we can do is we can just copy the bytes from disk into memory, interpret them as this type of struct, and access everything. So I don't have to go through here and say, for example, okay, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Okay, index 11 is the attributes. So I read from the directory entry, go to index 11, and interpret the attributes that way. I don't need to do that. I just load it into this struct, you know, and then access dir, adder, and C. This is typically what like real file system code is going to do rather than try to deal with like byte indexes and so on. Now, to make this struct work, we need to do some special things. And one thing is we need to tell our compiler, and unfortunately there's not a portable way of doing this, so this is the GCC or Clang way of doing it, where we use this extension to say disable padding. So normally compilers add padding to structs because they don't want to split values across pages or cache blocks. If you think of splitting a value across a page, when the processor accesses it, it needs to check two page table entries, and you might think that that could be slower, and in fact is a bunch slower. So compilers try really hard to keep you from doing that, but in this case, we care a lot more about making sure that this has the exact same layout as on disk than the compiler keeping us from splitting values across pages or cache blocks. So we're telling it here, no, even if you have to do that, it's okay. I wanted this to have no extra, you know, wasted space to keep me from doing that. We also need to make sure we used fixed sizes for everything, which is why I used these 8-bit and 16-bit and 32-bit unsigned int type defs rather than using int, because the size of int might vary between, you know, different machines. So here I'm saying, here's the exact size. Now another issue we would need to deal with is endianness. And if I was worried about big endian systems, we want to have some sort of routine for accessing these that swap the bytes on demand or something like that. In this case, we're just going to assume we're running on little endian, and it happens that fat stores everything in little endian because it was designed on a little endian system, so we're not going to worry about it. So questions about how I set up this struct to match that disk layout? So something else you might notice is I have horrible names here. Like, I am not under any illusions that this is a good way of naming a variable. You might ask, where did I come up with these names? They're from Microsoft's documentation. So I decided that probably we're pointing to this documentation because it's the source for how the file system works. So the structs match it. That doesn't mean it's a good idea. It's just what Microsoft did, and I figure it's better to match the documentation. It's not an advice for how you should name your variables in real code. Besides, you know, code that uses such documentation. Okay, so now we know what directory entries look like. And so basically our procedure now, given a file name like this, is that we have a sequence of, we find the foo directory by reading directory entries in some root directory. Then we use the foo directory, read its directory entries using its cluster numbers to find bar, read bar's directory entries to find baz, then finally find file.txt, get its cluster numbers. And we have one step missing here of where does this root directory come in? We're gonna get to that in a bit, but questions about like how this procedure works besides that. So where's the root directory? How do we know that? And there's actually a bunch of information we kind of need to know about the file system that's kind of global. One of this is where the root directory is. There's other things like how big are clusters? Because I told you it varies. Like, I need some way of knowing that. And the answer we're going to have is that it's going to be in the file system header. So what we're going to do is we're going to say at the beginning of the disk in the first sector, we're always going to put information about how the file system was set up. So when we're setting up the file system, we're going to decide how big are clusters. And we're going to write down our decision. So we're going to have fields in this header saying the header is, you know, sectors are 512 bytes, and we have 4 of them per cluster. So now when I'm given a already set up file system to use, in my OS, I'm just going to read this and to figure out, okay, now I know how big clusters are. We're also going to use this to figure out where the fat is. So the way that happens to be encoded is that there's a count of what are called reserve sectors, and the fat starts after that. So in this example, I've decided that there's 5 reserve sectors before the fat. So I count 5 sectors. After that's where the fat starts. And I can use that knowledge to look up any particular index in there. And you might ask, well, how do we know how big the fat is? We're just going to write that down in this header. So here I've written down that it's 11 sectors. So I have 11 sectors for the fat. And another thing we're going to write down is the first cluster of the root directory. So in this case, I've chosen, when I set up this disk, apparently, that cluster 10 is where the root directory starts. And that's how I'm going to find the root directory. So there's another curious field in here, which is number of fats. So it turns out that the file system commonly stores not just one fat, but 2 of them. You might ask, why do we need 2? It contains information about the next cluster for each cluster. Like, there's only going to be one possibility. And the answer is that the other copies are backups. So the idea is that hard drives especially often fail in a way where only part of the hard drive will be unreadable. And it would be really inconvenient if this part of the hard drive became unreadable. So we have a backup copy of that data. So if that scenario happens, we aren't completely out of luck. Okay. So questions about our header? So questions, what are the reserve sectors for? I'm not actually sure what information is typically in there, but they're space the file system can set aside for other things. I'm not, like, I suspect some stuff related to booting might be in there. But at the least, you need to reserve space to account for the header itself. That a satisfactory answer? So that's our header, and like our other structs, I can represent what our header as a struct. And so here's like my struct carefully written out. We have our bytes per sector and sectors per cluster. We have our reserve sector count I showed you. We have our number of FATs and some other information about that, and so on. Okay, so yeah, that's there. The question is, does it also store a backup of the root directory? My understanding is typically not. I'm not actually sure offhand, but probably not. It would make sense to, so I'm not like, wouldn't be shocked if it's sometimes done. Though, there are like, this sort of ad hoc backup important thing scheme is maybe not the best strategy for keeping yourself from losing data. So, and even though it was common, was and is commonly done. So now that we've talked about reading files and we've gone the whole thing, so we can start from the header, figure out where everything on the disk is, find the root directory, so take a file, read it. Let's talk about making files. And there's a couple things we have to do. So one thing we need to do is add a directory entry. So, you know, if space left in directory, so if we have unused entries or space at the end marked unused, you know, replace, you know. Otherwise, we need a new cluster. And we need to choose clusters to store file data too. So we have these two cases where we might need to choose clusters. Everything else, I think, we kind of understand how to do. Once we know where to put a directory entry, adding it for the file is straightforward, assuming we know all the information to put in there, like the first cluster. And we learned about how we have this sort of linked list of clusters. Once we know what clusters we want, we know how to write them in the array to set up that linked list. But our question is, how do we find free clusters? Like, we need to know what clusters are available. And the answer is we're going to use the FAT to store this information. Because if a cluster is free, well, it doesn't have a next cluster. So we'll just store, in this example, 0 to represent a free entry. And the idea is that we'll just scan through the file location table for zeros, and that's how we're going to know these entries are free. And when we want to, say, write a file, we're going to figure out how many clusters we need, and in some manner, we're going to choose the appropriate number. So let's say I want to write a 3-cluster file. I just choose 3 clusters. Here I've arbitrarily chosen 21, 22, and 24. I could have chosen other ones. I just chose those. And that's where I'm going to decide to put the file. And I'm going to set up the links to make that happen. And we'll talk, when we talk about how hard drives and SSDs work, about maybe there's some considerations in which ones we should choose, but we have the flexibility to choose any set of free ones. So the question is, what if I don't know how big my file will be in advance? Then I can allocate the first 3, and if I want to allocate another one later, like I can just choose, for example, 27, modify 24 to point to it, and add it later that way. Does that answer your question? And we can, and the question is, as we go, yes, we can keep going as we want. We can just keep adding a cluster and link it up at the end. The question is, what if I run out of memory while allocating? I can avoid running out of memory because, worst case, I only need to look at, I can go a cluster at a time. So here I'm allocating it all together, but I could have done this piecemeal. I could have allocated 21, then scanned again to allocate 22, and so on. Question is, how do I know which cluster is next pointer to modify? I want to make it so when I'm finished, when I look at all the next pointers together, I get the whole file. So I look at like where am I adding data in the file at the end? So what's the thing at the end of the file now? If the file doesn't exist yet, I'm choosing where the file starts so it doesn't, so I'm not modifying a next pointer besides the one to point, say, this is the end of the file now. And always, when I'm making a new end of the file, I'm going to modify that next pointer to indicate it's the sentinel value indicating the end. Does that answer your questions? Okay. So that's on file that way. So we make a choice. Yeah. And yes, I showed doing this all at once, but we can like do it piecemeal because we can set up each link, you know, we can set up each link one at a time. So that's writing the file data, and then we have to add a directory entry. So our simple case is we find where the directory data is stored. We take find an unused entry in there and just replace it without changing the size of the directory. We can also have a case where maybe we look at the directory and every single directory entry in there is actually used for a file. In that case, what we need to do is we need more space for directory entries. So we use the same procedure we used to allocate the file to choose a place to put the directory, the next part of the directory, and we create a whole bunch of unused directory entries, fill in one of them with the file. And notice here, we're pointing to the first thing we allocated for the file. Okay. So questions? About how we're dealing with, you know, our two possibilities for dealing with the directory. Okay, so with that in mind, I have a little exercise here. So I'm saying in this exercise, we have a file A, B, C.txt. So directory A contains directory B, contains C.txt. And first I'm asking, let's say C.txt didn't exist and we create it. Which of these six things are we going to modify either definitely or potentially as part of that process? And let's ignore modification time and update. So if you're paying attention, you notice that the directory entries contain like a modification time and some other timestamps. Let's ignore those to keep things simpler. And are you seeing a poll? If not, let me know. No. Okay, great work, Zoom. Let's try this again. Now are we seeing a poll? Great. And oh, and let's assume to keep things simpler with data. So we're creating a non-empty with data in it. We're creating it as non-empty. To avoid questions about what do we do for empty files. I'll give another 30 seconds or so. So most of us think that we need data clusters for C. So this is to store the data. So if it has data in it, so I agree with that. And also think we need FAT entries to indicate used. So like at the least we need to make they were previously free, you know, not free. If we don't mark them as not free, something else might overwrite them, and that would be really bad for the data we're trying to store. So we definitely need F and C. Now, since we're creating the C.txt, we need to have a directory entry for it, and that's going to be stored in the data clusters for B. And, you know, maybe allocate new cluster for, and so hopefully we can fit the directory entry in one of the clusters already allocated for B, but maybe we need to allocate a new cluster, in which case we might need to update the FAT entries to reflect that new cluster. We need to make a pointer to it and also set it as the end of the file, end of the directory file. And possibly be. So questions on that. And I don't think we need to change A because other than the modification time for B, nothing relevant to A is actually changed. Everything that's important is in B or C's information. So questions on this. You can ask, so let's go to the second part. So let's say we have c.txt exists, it has data in it, and we have to truncate it down to 0 bytes. So to make it into an empty file from being a non-empty file. So what do we need to modify to make that happen? And hopefully you see a poll. Yes, someone sees a poll at least, okay. I'll give another 30 seconds or so, or I guess, yeah. It looks like I have a majority of answers, a super majority of answers. Okay, so most people say the data clusters for C. And I agree it would be permissible to modify, but we never actually need to modify the data clusters for C. Need to change just mark as free. Mark as free in FAT. So this is for two. We never need to change these. We can just mark them as free in the FAT, and later on, if we use them for something else, they'll be overwritten. So almost always, the file system won't bother actually overwriting things that we truncate because we just mark it as not pointed to, as not in use, and there's no reason to waste time overwriting it. Now, I could imagine us actually overwriting it if we were like worried about when you truncate, I don't want to be able to recover that later, like if it was a security thing, but that's very atypical. So typically, almost always in this case, we're just going to mark it as free in the FAT entry and get rid of the pointer to it. So the question is, the info about them being free or not is in the FAT entry and not the cluster itself? Yes, correct. So there's something else we have to do. We have to update the directory entry. And so here, we're going to update size plus and maybe first cluster in the directory entry. So we have to do that. We're going to do that in the directory entry, which is stored in the data clusters for B. And as I mentioned, to mark it as free, we're actually going to modify its FAT entries to mark clusters as free, at least if it was, we're probably going to need to do that, especially if it's multiple clusters. So I would say that probably the answer to this would be C, E. So questions on how I got that? And note that we don't need to change the FAT entry for B because we already have the directory entry allocated. We can just overwrite it in place. And that's what we're going to do because we need to, we can't leave the old one there. We have to actually change it. So questions about how I got this answer? Okay. And so in talking about how we truncate things, I got to most of how we delete files. So deleting a file is doing this thing where we mark the entries as free and update the directory entry, but rather than updating it, if we went to delete the file, rather than updating the directory entry to be, say it has size 0, we just mark it as unused. So I have one final exercise. So we'll do, let's just focus for time reasons on the first part here. This first question. Think about this. So here I'm saying, I have this as a separate poll here. So saying, and can you see the poll? Saying we have a FAT file system and I'm storing a directory of 230 kilobyte files. So for both the direct, how many clusters do we need to do this? And remember, we need clusters for both the files that, the 30 kilobyte files and the directory that contains them. Give you until have 30 seconds left so I have time to explain things. Looks like I'll leave the poll open, but looks like we don't have any here loading yet. So I'm just going to explain it in the time we have left. So we have each file takes 15 clusters because that's 30K is going to be 15 248 byte clusters. So times 200 is going to be 3,000 clusters for the files in the directory, but we need to store the directory. We have 200 directory entries, which is going to be 6,400 bytes. And this is 3.125 clusters. But remember, we have to assign whole clusters to the directory. So that's four clusters with part of that, part of last cluster unused. Used, so we get 3,004 clusters, which I'll write with the correct number of zeros. So any questions about how I came across that answer? I know not many people got a chance to do that, or otherwise I'm done because I'm out of time. So the 200 files math. So we have 200 files. Each of them needs a directory entry. So we need about 6,400 bytes for all those directory entries. That's 200 times 32, because there are 32 byte directory entries. And 6,400 divided by 2048 is 3.125. At least it is if I do this. And do you have enough information to start the next homework? You should, yes. So why is it four clusters? So we have, it's 3.125 for the data, but remember we have to assign a whole cluster. We can't assign 0.125 of a cluster to the directory. So we use four for those 3.125. That's needed to store all the directory entries. Does that answer your question? Okay, any other questions?